Are we live?
We're live.
Welcome to the R.A. the Rugged Man Show, a.k.a. the Ignorant Long Island Guys Podcast. I'm here with my talentless cameraman, Mickey Shershenovich. He has no right being here, but he's here. Say hello.
Hello.
Fuck Mickey. You know, every time I bring him on here, he just stinks out the fucking show. Where's Afro? There he is. The star of VH1's The Breaks. You've seen him on The Tonight Show this year. You've seen him on Queen Latifah. You've seen him everywhere. Make some noise. You got the wrong seat, though, man. I should have directed you better. Go one
you
seat
want me
back.
Again?
Nah, you could just switch seats. It's okay. You don't have to do it again, man. Okay, walk in. Go ahead. All right. So if any directors are watching, he wants to do films next. This is All Flows Reach Out. This is my young protege. He's much more entertaining and photogenic than Mickey Shershenovich, so I decided he might make a good co-host for me. You look, he's like the black Mexican Ed McMahon. Today, we have a special, special, special guest. The OG icon, horror film legend, and a good close friend of mine, Frank Henenlotter. And you know, if you're familiar with his films, Basket Case, Frankenhooker, Brain Damage, Bad Biology, Basket Case 2 and 3, which he doesn't want me to mention, I'm sure, but I love 2 and 3. You know, I think he likes 2, doesn't like 3. But just an icon, respected by all your peers, all the big Hollywood movies steal from him. But fuck all that shit. Not just him being an iconic B-film exploitation master, he's also one of the greatest film historians of our time. A lot of people don't know that. And I would put him knowledge for knowledge against anybody. The Tarantinos and Scorsese's, all those guys that are always doing the film interviews about films, I'll put Henenlotter against all of them. This is the be-all, end-all film historian of modern times and my brother, Mr. Frank Henenlotter. Dangerous.
Hello.
Francois
Pinky.
So, I just want to talk and nerd out about films. So, you know,
I hate films.
You've always hated them, right?
They suck.
So, this is my boy Afro.
Yes, I know. I met him. He's great.
I'm in the presence of a true horror movie OG. Yes, sir. Actually, sir, you are the first horror movie director I've ever met in my life. Well, first movie director I've ever met.
He's all start. Well, you made movies before, so you've met movie directors before.
I'm just saying, I saw a Basket Case when I was like 10 years old. Like, that's my joint. Like, I'm just saying.
You shouldn't be watching that at 10 years old.
Yeah. No,
I showed it to my sister when she was 4, and I destroyed her life. Like, I think she has emotional issues still today, you know?
I think most of the people that tell me they're fans of the film saw it when they were way too young.
Yeah, well, I remember being like 7 or 8, and the girl with the huge breast and a monster fucking her, and it was all slimy. Like,
but you know what that still slime was?
What?
The trick of anything is doing good sound effects, okay? And you got to kind of imagine in your head what it's going to be. And you have no money for this stuff. So I whipped up a can of tuna fish with a lot of mayonnaise. This is real.
So the sound of Bilal fucking the girl?
Stuck the fork in right next to the microphone and just kept going.
But you know, when you're 8 years old, I didn't even care a monster was fucking around. I'm like, there's titties. Titties. There's a monster. Titties.
Right. In fact, all the surgical sound effects was I bought a bunch of vegetables and fruit. And, you know, I had all those scalpels. I used to collect scalpels. And just put the headphones on because I didn't know which was going to work. And just stick something in. And then you stick something in and all of a sudden it goes. It had to go through kind of a hard hit first, you know, and then it has to be juicy in there so you can dig out, you know. when we were doing Basket Case 2, they were doing Silence of the Lambs, the sound for that, and Ferrara's King of New York.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they were really a quality outfit, and they didn't have any sound effects for this. So I said to them, I'll show you. Just put a tarp on the floor, and I'll bring in a bunch of vegetables and fruit. They didn't quite, you know, they're going, all right, let him, you know, what are we going to say, you know? And I'm sticking stuff in, and they're looking, you know, they're behind the booth, and I'm thinking, and they're not reacting. All of a sudden, I stick something in one, and they all go,
yeah.
So I knew, okay, we got it, you know?
Yeah. So let's just geek out right now. Let's say favorite monster in the history.
When I was 8 years old, I was lucky enough that, you know, my dad was taking me to the movies so I could see horror films because he loved them. But also the first Universal horror films came on television. And I thought Frankenstein was the coolest monster in the world. I mean, I just loved it. I mean, it's why I made Frankenhooker. I still can't get over it, you know? I also love the absolute crap films. I mean, there's nothing better than those, you know? I just rock bottom, just god-awful pieces of shit I just find so fabulous. Stuff like, Duane Esper's Maniac, 1934.
You know,
what the hell is that? What is going on there? I mean, it's like half of it is a nudie film, and half of it is this guy being a mad doctor, and it's and then they stop the movie every so often to give you definitions of mental illness. What's going on here? You know? And in one glorious moment, he takes a cat, and he pops the eyeball out of the cat. And I mean, they had a one-eyed cat.
What year was this? This was before Code, right?
1934. Oh, yeah. It was the year of the Code, right? This film like Maniac was made for theaters that didn't give a shit about the Code.
Oh, wow.
That's why they did the exploitation films of the 30s is what I love so much, because they were dealing with drugs and sex, and they didn't get any Code, and they would play Skid Row theaters, and they would play small towns.
So even after Code was enforced, those movies could still play?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, absolutely.
But they just weren't allowed to make them anymore.
It was the major studios that signed the production code. So it was Paramount, Universal, and MGM that had to tone down their act. But if you were a sleazy producer and you got little money, you know, throw some tits in and you know, do a dirty story or something like that. The trouble was,
a lot of people don't know there was titties in movies in the 20s and 30s.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Casual stuff, too.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a Cecil B. DeMille film called The Sign of the Cross, and Claudette Colbert, great actress, she's won an Oscar and everything, she takes a milk bath and she's in it, you see the tits bumping up and down. It's like, you know, it's like, whoa, you know, back that up. Did I just, yeah, you did.
Yeah, so
you know, but
20s, was that the 20s or 30s?
The trick was, though, that you couldn't go too far with the films because local towns would shut you down. You know, if a sheriff was in there and didn't like your film, he'd bust you and throw the print away and burn it and all that stuff. So you had the First Amendment, really, nobody paid attention to back then. It was like, if there's a sheriff running the town and somebody complains, he's going to do it. But what they used to do also is sometimes they'd have a film that was mild. And if they knew there was no one of legal authority in the studio and the audience liked it, then they'd put on a reel of like nudist camp shit and stuff like that.
Wow,
you know, and the people would leave happy and tell their friends, oh, you gotta go. It was great stuff.
What's your earliest movie memory that perverted you, that made you, you know, obsessed with exploitation and monsters fucking people?
Well,
what's the earliest perverted?
I don't remember perversion as much as I remember fear, because I really took this stuff seriously back then.
Oh.
You know? And my dad wanted to see The Fly,
original
Fly. Yeah. He took me to see that. And I was so upset by that film. I was so terrified. Just the opening scene with the body covered with blood, I'm thinking, it's fucking blood. I mean, I never saw blood before like that. I'm thinking, good. And then this goddamn man insect, I was so upset. I was so terrified. I wanted to leave the theater.
Wow.
But I knew that if I did, my dad wouldn't take me to see anymore.
Oh.
So I had to bluff it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know, and he says to me afterwards, so that didn't scare you. No. And I mean, hours later, I'm going, oh God. You know what I mean? But I had fun. They were fun to me. I remember going to see House on Haunted Hill, and it had the skeleton, except it wasn't a skeleton like everybody thinks. It was a balloon skeleton. It was the most pathetic thing you've ever seen. And this is the Limerick Theater. And there must have been, you know, 100 of us kids, because you could seat 1,000 people. And every candy box bar, every popcorn box, everything was thrown at that skeleton. It was bouncing all over the thing. You know, we didn't care. We were kids. I want to kill the skeleton. You know, so I,
that shit looks fake.
Yeah, it was. Well, it really did look fake. And well, I mean, I used to get confused over the years because I'd read about this skeleton they'd have and pull over. And I'm thinking, I don't know if my memory's playing tricks, but I remember it was a balloon they pulled over.
Okay, so top three, don't got to be top three, but underrated film directors in history that don't get enough credit.
Well, for years I would have put Jess Franco on the top of the list, as you know, because I always felt like I was the only one that liked him. I mean, it's all different now. He's loved and adored. I remember when we did Brain Damage, and Gorzone wanted to do an interview with me, and I said, I will, but let me talk about my favorite director. Well, he had then started to shoot the film Faceless.
Oh, yeah.
And Benoit Lestang, good friend of mine, went to the set, to visit the set, and showed Franco the issue of Gorzone. And Franco said, oh my God, this is the first time I've ever read anything good about me in English.
Wow.
And a few weeks later, I got a beautiful poster that's still in my bedroom of A Virgin Among the Living Dead, signed by Jess Franco in December 1987. So.
Wow.
But he's always been on the top of my list. I keep forgetting that he's now an accepted icon.
Yeah, yeah. But, well, you became friends with Franco years later in the Romaine.
Yeah. No, I did. I met them, and it was just beyond great. I mean, I can't tell you. I was so intimidated in his presence. I didn't even want to meet him. I just wanted to pray to him. So it was.
There was a Franco movie. I had my little brother there.
Oh God!
And you were like.
Well, your brother was being bratty.
Yeah, he was, but he was young. And you said, "Is it okay to play?" I said, "Yeah, sure, Frank. Whatever you got."
His brother was being really bratty and acting like nothing was no big deal. I figured I wanted to shut him up with one. So I put on
Jess Franco. Which Franco movie with the crabs? Which one?
Yeah,
is it?
Now called Lorna the Exorcist.
Okay.
But the print I had was called Possessed by the Devil at the time.
Okay.
And I put on Lorna the Exorcist.
It's a VHS tape. It's before DVDs.
Yeah. And there's a moment where the camera's close up on Monica Swin's crotch, and little crabs are coming all over her.
Coming out of a vagina.
But they don't actually come out.
But it looks
all
like
over. Yeah, you get the idea.
My brother was like, "You're a pervert!"
and he freaked. It was great.
And Frank was like, "Shut this, I said, "Johnny, I said you could handle anything."
He couldn't handle that one.
Couldn't handle his Franco. What's the sleaziest shit you've seen go down in 42nd Street when you was younger?
You mean on the screen or in the audience?
Both.
Everything written today about 42nd Street is ridiculous hype. It's portrayed today as a street where if every time you went to a movie, you saw a murder or something. You know, I was going there since I was 15 years old. I used to cut high school to come in. And believe me, it's nothing like that. Okay, yeah, occasionally you'd see a fight. It was a great atmosphere because the audience was mostly transients because the bus depot was right down the street. And mostly, I guess, minorities. You could count the white faces in there, okay? But it was the most honest crowd on the planet. It was so, because they wanted to love every film, but there was no pretense involved. They wanted to see blood, guns, and tits. And that's it, you know, and a lot of violence. And if you delivered them, they loved the film. If you didn't deliver, if the film was boring, they turn on a radio.
they start playing boombox and shit.
Occasionally they would get really angry if the film sucked and that stuff. So occasionally there would be these are all theaters that they're all gone now. They tore the stupid city, tore the theaters down, but they were originally the Broadway theaters on 42nd Street. So like you'd go to the Harris Theater, I'll use that as an example, was where John Barrymore once did Hamlet, okay? And they had two balconies from the old days where, there was standing room only. And the second balcony was really old. And one day they were showing Snuff and Torso, and I forget what the other one was. I had already seen them, so I went for the third film, which I don't remember that. But I realized, oh my God, the second balcony's open. Let me go up there. And I went up there, and everyone was having sex up there. And I got out of there fast because I didn't want them to think I'm watching.
Yeah,
what I mean? Yeah, yeah. But it was like.
And how old were you for
whoa,
that?
Whoa, what?
How old were you for that? When
maybe about 19.
Oh, yeah.
Well, no, I had to be later than that because it was Snuff and Torso. So that's in the 70s.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But it
Yo, which, by the way, you made me a copy of the trailer of Torso when I was younger, and it was like, Torso!
Yeah.
Torso! Torso! Do you remember the trailer you gave me?
Yeah.
It was like, Torso!
Yeah,
it was the silliest trailer ever.
But, it was so much fun in there. I went in to see, it was snowing one night, and I went to the New Amsterdam to see Blackenstein. How's that for one, okay? And
you've never seen Blackenstein, right?
No, oh, sir.
Tell them about the monster in it.
Well, the monster was hilarious because he literally had a square afro. I'm not making this
We're
up.
We're going to make you a Blackenstein in your next video.
Square afro. And he's like, we got to do that. And when I went in there, I didn't think there was anybody in the theater because it was only like maybe 11 of us. But everybody was in the balcony up there. And there was one guy up there who... I mean, the film was just a piece of shit. So he starts doing, like, making comments out loud, and no one cared because he was really funny. Yeah. He was better than the film, okay? So he's watching the film, and there's a scene where the monster comes after this orderly in a hospital, and the guy's saying, come on, rip his arm off. And the monster rips the guy's arm off, and he goes, oh, shit, oh, my God. He thought he made it happen. And he's going, oh, man, he's saying it. I didn't see this before. And funniest guy. So this continued, and then the next scene, there's Liz Renee wakes up in bed in the middle of the night with this hairstyle that's, 3 feet high. And she wakes up holding it. That's how she's sleeping. Okay. Anyway, the monster comes in, and the guy decides to take it a step further. So he's going, rip out her guts. And the monster starts ripping out of her guts. And this guy freaked out. He's going, oh, my God, I can make it happen. Well, then nothing else worked. Then he starts screaming, cut off the head, and nothing else worked. But at least for those
two. The first two, he got it.
Yeah. It was a crazy, wonderful atmosphere. It really was. I'll tell you my favorite gross-out story on 42nd Street, because there was all kinds of crazy shit would happen there. Occasionally, rats would run down the aisle being chased by a cat.
In the theater.
Yeah, in the theater, and people would go, I went to see, this is at the New Amsterdam, which is where that Disney now bought, where they premiered The Lion King. And originally, and back then, it was the home of the Ziegfeld Follies. It was the most opulent theater on 42nd Street. It has a garden theater on the roof. It was really stunning. Well, I'm in there one day seeing Frankenstein's Castle of Freaks.
Yeah, I love that one. You gave me a VHS of that years ago.
Well, I don't love that one. But anyway, there was a bag woman in there, one of those homeless, crazy women, you know? And you got to learn, you don't open your mouth to people on 42nd Street. Just shut up. If you don't like something, move or go or leave. And this woman was sitting there mumbling or something like this. So this stupid-ass white guy who's not... Now, let me just stress that there was like nobody... There was very few of us in the orchestra. There was very few of us in the theater. Mm-hmm. And, everybody was like, if you're sitting here, there's like two rows before the next person and maybe three rows next. So she's sitting there mumbling, and this stupid-ass guy turns around and goes, hey, will you shut up? And I'm thinking, oh, what a jerk. And a couple of minutes later, all of a sudden the guy goes, he's sitting in his seat, and he's going, oh, my God. And he jumps up and runs up the aisle and apparently out of the theater. And we're sitting there, just like maybe what 9 of us left, and we're going, what the hell just happened? what was that, So we're sitting there, and now the first person, a couple of minutes later, the first person behind the woman on the row behind her, all of a sudden goes, oh, Christ, Jesus, God. He jumps up. He's going, oh, my God. And he runs up the aisle. So now we're sitting there going, uh-oh. I mean, I'm thinking there's rats.
Yeah.
So I've got my feet up on the seat. A minute later, the next person. It was like everybody. This was
slowly
a
running out.
All in order. And I'm sitting there one by one. And it's like, and finally, it's up to me. And I'm thinking, okay, I'll know any minute. And I was going to go, oh! And I realized what it was.
What was it?
It was the smell of, those theaters were refrigerated? Refrigerated diarrhea. What the woman did was she shit all over the seat. She let it spray. All over the seat.
Oh.
Okay? I mean, and it was...
So why was it refrigerated? I don't get
it. Because they were all... They didn't have air conditioning. It was refrigeration.
Oh.
They always had a thing cooled by refrigeration.
Oh, wow.
So it's like, so it's like already foul, but now it's cold foul.
Shit all over the fucking theater with frozen shit.
So I
Icy shit.
I got up and ran, but I didn't want to leave the theater. So I went up to the balcony, and what did I see up there? Well, all the other guys except the first one.
Oh, yeah.
They were all sitting there. And as I come up, they're waving to me like, yeah, you too, huh?
Yeah,
you know,
because
no one. And then the best part was, now we're sitting there watching new people come in the theater.
And see the shit.
All right? So and people are walking in, and everybody's going, no, don't. And they're looking around thinking, what the hell is this? And all of a sudden they go, ah! And come running up.
They should remake that scene like Hitchcock and the Birds.
Yeah,
like,
well,
no,
yeah, right.
Done, you know?
And it was one of the best days I've ever had in a theater. And finally,
awesome.
one of the management guys, I mean, he was wearing a little Usher uniform or something. They used to wear silly little uniforms back then. He comes walking down the aisle to see what everybody's screaming about. Looks oversees it and just shakes his head and walks away. And I don't think that shit was ever cleaned up until Disney probably bought the place. I mean, you know.
What are some of the other black exploitation movies you've seen? I know you saw Welcome Home, Brother Charles.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
What were some of the movies you used to go see?
You know,
Dolomite, you told me about
Dolomite
those.
Well, Dolomite was great for me because, you know, I'm a white kid from Long Island. I have no urban experience. So, and I was only interested in seeing the movies, you know.
Yeah.
So I didn't understand what was going on. I mean, here's how naive I was, and then I'll get back to that story if I don't forget it. There was never any hookers on 42nd Street. There were at the corner and, you know, and especially on 8th Avenue, but I never saw any on 42nd Street. But I used to see cowboys.
Oh, wow.
And I'm thinking, how come there's so many cowboys here? There would always be these cowboys standing there not doing anything. And it was only years later when I realized they were male hustlers.
Oh,
they were gay
yeah,
hustlers.
So that
That's
was,
where they
that
got the title Midnight Cowboy from.
Because
they all dressed like cowboys. I'm saying, I didn't know. So anyway, I remember going to see Dolomite. And I already loved the film because Rudy Ray Moore is just great right from the get-go, even though I'd never heard of him before seeing him. But there's a moment where the film just stops, and he's in like a parking lot, and he starts doing this weird kind of weird poetry or rhyming.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm sitting there going, what the hell did they just stop a movie for this for? And meanwhile, the rest of the audience was howling and laughing. And I realized, okay, they know something I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was like the birth of what, you know, that early rap.
Yeah, yeah.
And fortunately, a year later, Human Tornado came out. The moment he started doing this, I'm laughing like, oh, yeah, I know what this is all about.
Yeah, because, you know, Snoop Dogg and Kane, they all looked up to Dolomite before he passed away.
Yeah,
the first time I ever seen Petey Wheatstraw, you showed me when the mother gave birth to the watermelon, and then he came out and beat the hell out of his dad. He was like, you're the one that was beating me in my head the last 9 months.
Like, you've been poking me. And that was his best film. And he did one after that, you know, Disco Godfather,
the problem was they
planned it being a PG.
Oh, wow.
So
an anti-drug PG movie.
Yeah,
to,
yeah. Wow. You know, not his formula. And even in the film, he goes, you stupid mother, mm-mm.
Oh, wow.
And I'm thinking, no, that's not Dolomite. That's not Rudy.
Yeah.
That's not Rudy.
You also put me on with some of the greatest black films ever. Like, you know, you taught me Paul Robeson and the Emperor Jones and Green Pastures.
They weren't exploitation.
No, that's what I'm saying.
That's
why I said exploitation is one thing.
Yeah.
But you put me on to the icons.
Yeah.
Like, I actually heard Paul Robeson through like a rap lyric or something.
Yeah.
But then, like, I didn't know who he was. And then I was like 18, 19, and you were like, oh, you're Paul Robeson? And you put on some Paul Robeson films, and I was like, wow.
Yeah, yeah. No, he's beyond brilliant. He's one of the most beautiful. But so is Rex Ingram, another guy with the most beautiful voice.
What's the movie where he played God or
Green Pastures?
That is Green Pastures.
He's so great. He's just, you know, he's God, but he's just dressed normal, you know? And he's walking down this country road, and he says, and he sees flowers and goes, how's all you flowers today? And they go, we's wonderful, Lord. Just beautiful stuff. Just
what
beautiful.
I love is there's recently been a Blu-ray come out called Pioneers of Black Cinema, which is important because
right?
these were the films that were made for an all-black audience. You know, segregation, you couldn't have black folks in a white theater, so they had their own theaters, okay? I would have liked to have gone into them, you know? So they had movies, low-budget films to play those theaters, and there weren't that many of them, but there was still enough if you made it film cheap enough, you can get them out there. And most of them are lost, but they found a pile of them at a warehouse in Texas years ago, and they've just put this out of a bunch of them on there, transferred into high definition, and really good ones. Dirty Gertie from Harlem, classic. And the best of them all is The Blood of Jesus.
Yeah, it's great.
Which is just... It's naive and charming and crazy and loopy and just perfect. Because it's sincere. So you can't, while you're laughing at it,
black directors too in them days.
This was Spencer Williams.
Yeah, that was his name, right?
Yeah, he achieved fame later on with the Amos and Andy TV show. Yeah. And then Robeson's best film is probably Emperor Jones.
Emperor Jones, classic.
And there's a really, well, considering today's PC world, it's kind of interesting because they wanted to restore the film. But he uses the word nigger like every other sentence. I'm the boss nigger here. I'm the head nigger. Okay. That's what the play was. That's what he's doing. At some point, when the film was still in release, they thought, Jesus, we can't have that in this. So they didn't just bleep it out. They actually cut the frames out.
Oh, cut the frames out so you couldn't see the film
how
it was.
I'm the boss here, and I'm the head here.
Wow.
And, so
that's rewriting history, man.
Well, I believe that. I mean, you can open with a something that says, you know, like Warner Brothers does, this is what it was like back then.
Yeah.
We don't condone this, but it's also a part of history.
Because Paul Robeson himself would be disappointed that happened.
Well, they put all that back in.
Oh, good.
And it was funny because here's the reverse of what goes on today. They meticulously found prints and they would edit the word back in.
Oh,
so now it's about as complete as it gets. They're still missing a sequence in the film where he runs and through the swamp or something like that, and he's out of his mind.
He was a political activist.
Oh, absolutely.
Legendary iconic figure.
My God.
He's not going to do no exploitation.
Listen. His greatest moment in film is in James Whale's film Showboat, where he sings Old Man River.
Yeah.
And you could almost cry hearing it. He's so perfect. He was great. And he was such a political activist that, of course, the U.S. government had to shut him down.
Of course. Yeah.
And he...
They did it to Rex Ingram, too, right? Didn't they try to get him from crossing the border?
Yeah. But they pretty much destroyed Paul Robeson's career.
What'd they do to him? Basically?
Well, he advocated socialism. Now, there's a difference between socialism and what Russia was doing, but suddenly he was a commie lover.
Oh.
You know, and that's how they can nail you. They did that to Chaplin, too.
No,
I was going to say my favorite of all those guys is Mantan Moreland. I think the funniest comic of the 40s. I just think, and he was...
He has a bad reputation now because they say, oh, he was doing, you know, too much of the eyeball stuff.
It was the NAACP that put a stop to Amos and Andy and destroyed Mantan Moreland's life because they wanted to erase the stereotype that was prevalent in the 40s.
Yeah.
But if you can look past the stereotype at what Mantan was doing, he may have been the stereotype in that. If he was spooked, his eyes would bulge and he'd shake his head. But in so many of the films, he was smarter.
Smarter than everybody.
Yes. Yeah. Okay? You know, and that was the genius.
And
with
as
him.
A comedian, he was a comedian. And every so often,
he'd come out with these lines, like in King of the Zombies, this woman is saying, there's no zombies here. And instead of saying, you're a liar, he says, woman, you is a prevaricator. Whoa, what the hell was that? You know? He made a whole bunch of all black titles that I have not seen. Mantan Goes to Town, She's Too Mean for Me. I mean, stuff like that, my God, I wish they would surface. But he is absolutely the funniest comic of the 1940s. Yeah. He's just, and you know, it's like you can spot him in like major studio films where they would, you know, they would put all black actors, you know, like a waiter, a butler, you know, baggage carrier,
like
something
typical,
like that.
We need a black person
but
to do that.
In the low budget films, they made him a star.
Yeah.
Like, so he's like...
And they'd advertise him on the posters in the
absolutely.
Hood. You know, they'd
see,
be like,
Monogram...
They'd put the white people in the back if he was... And put Mantan in front of the poster.
Monogram was a company that made movies so cheaply. It was pathetic. They didn't count their dollars they made. They counted their pennies, okay, and nickels and dimes. I mean, they would... So they knew that if they put Mantan in the film, they could sell the film also to the all-black theaters.
Wow.
And so they made Mantan a star. And he is... Brilliant.
Yeah.
Just absolutely brilliant.
Mirkoni versus Bernard Herrmann.
Bernard Herrmann is the king of it all, period. So there you go. And there's plenty of others I love and love and love. But to me, my heart is with Herman. So there you go.
What do you love about Herman? Which scores or
his overall mood, but also the instrumentation of it. Yeah. And that there's something so somber about his stuff and so deep and churning. And it's just, it always struck me with Herman that it's the absolute perfect musical choice for every film. You watch The Ghost of Mrs. Muir and you don't need to see the picture. The music is telling you, here's the tide coming in, here's the tide going out.
Wow.
I mean, it's just so fantastically beautiful. And he obviously had fun in Seventh Voyage of Sinbad. Sinbad fights an animated skeleton, you know, stop motion animation skeleton. And Herman, his music sounds like it's orchestrated with bones. It must have been a xylophone or something like that. But it's just in castanets, and it's the most perfect bone music you've ever heard in your life. It's just fabulous stuff.
And his first movie was Citizen Kane. Right?
Yeah.
And his last film was Taxi Driver, from there to there.
And in fact, when he did Citizen Kane, he even wrote the opera that they do in the film.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. That's all his stuff. And what happened was, you know, times change, and his music was started to be seen as old-fashioned, you know. And then he scored all these Hitchcock films, but then Hitchcock really did something really reprehensible in the way he fired Herman on the film Torn Curtain. I mean, he just did it brutally and badly, and they never spoke again. And let me back up. When they were doing Psycho, Hitchcock said, I don't want any music for the murder scene.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And Herman said, okay, no problem. And then when they were at the scoring session, Herman said, listen, I know you don't want music. Just let me listen. You know, just let me listen to something. You like it? Fine. You don't like it? Fine. And he put the shrieking violins. And Hitchcock just was like, you know, like, okay, that stays, you know. So on the film Torn Curtain, the same thing happened. And Herman wrote a score for the murder. And suddenly Hitchcock was enraged. And I think what their backstory is I think MCA, which controlled Hitchcock at that point, wanted a contemporary song to make it more modern.
Yeah.
And I think he just used that as an excuse in anyway.
Yeah.
And pretty much, and Herman suddenly was doing scores for a lot of very obscure, low-budget films.
Yeah.
And it was Scorsese who discovered him. But, Scorsese put him in Taxi Driver, and when Scorsese first heard the thing, according to what I've read, that bum, 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 he thought, oh, Jesus, this is all wrong. And then when he hears the sax cue and all this stuff, he realized, oh, my God, no, this isn't wrong. This is just perfection. And that was his last score, and he died after that, you know. And it's a shame because all of a sudden he was rediscovered again. He could have kept doing it for another 10 years at least, you know.
You know, a lot of these, big Hollywood guys doing the $100 million, $200 million movies, they're big and a lot of fans. And
I don't know about that. I mean, you hear that stuff. I have no evidence. I've never met Tarantino.
I got the evidence.
If they're big,
they had an article the other day.
Look, if they're big and a lot of fans, how come I can't get any work? I mean, you know, it's like if you're a fan, you know, hey, you know, let me make a movie to $200 grand. You know, come on.
Okay, so James Gunn, they just had an article. He did Galaxy of, Guardian of Galaxy. And they just had an article. It had one of his films and it had two of your films in it. And so he tweeted it.
Uh-huh.
And I said, oh, that's great that you're on the list with one of your idols, Henan Latta. And he retweeted me and said, so true. You know,
well,
so like,
you know, all right. I mean,
but so look, James Gunn, if you're watching him $1 million.
I don't want to, you know, all I'm saying is it's nice to have fans, but, you know, yeah. You know, I mean, I keep reading I'm a cult director. Well, I wish I had a cult.
Yeah.
I mean, what's the fun of not having a cult if you're a cult director?
It's a different.
Also, now I'm being called, the legendary. Well, how come I still have to pay rent then? I mean, there's no benefit, so what's the difference? I don't care about those terms.
Well, that's similar, different lanes, but remember the Orson Welles, when he got his Oscar speech, his lifetime achievement, and he said, then he used to hire me.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah, that was brilliant. That was just brought tears to my eyes that day.
Yeah.
It was brilliant.
And that's considered arguably the greatest filmmaker that ever lived, arguably. I'm not saying he is,
but I don't think it's arguable.
Yeah.
I would put him at the top of that.
Yeah.
I really would. Wow. I mean, there's You know, I mean, even his lesser films knocked me out.
Yeah, yeah.
So I have no problem with that, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, I mean, it's like, if you want to say, you know, for years it was Citizen Kane was the greatest film ever made. Now some other people, have, you know, Scorsese's behind it and that. Oh, now they've decided it's Vertigo. Hey, Vertigo's a good film, but it ain't the best, greatest film ever made.
It's a great, great, great one, though, yeah.
Yeah, but it ain't the greatest film ever made.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I mean, if you want to pick a Hitchcock film, do Psycho instead. But anyway, But I, you know, if Citizen Kane's arguably the greatest film ever made, I think the second greatest is La Dolce Vita. That's almost forgotten today.
I think La Dolce Vita is the greatest.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a masterpiece with so many layers.
Yeah, and every time I watch it, it's a different movie.
It is a different movie.
And every time I watch it, I take something different away from it. That doesn't happen with other films.
Yeah, it's layer after layer layer after layer, and every shot is perfection.
And I also love the films of Michael Powell. The Red Shoes is, I avoided it for years because it's about ballet.
Yeah.
That's what I thought it was about. It's not about ballet. It's any form of dance would have made that work, but it's a brilliant film, again, on so many levels, especially the color. And then Black Narcissus with the Nun. I mean, so many.
Peeping Tom.
Peeping Tom.
And Stairway to Heaven.
Stairway to Heaven was, oh, my God.
What was the real title of that one?
The British title is A Matter of Life and Death.
Yeah, that one's.
But, you know, when I was six and seven, I was a lonely kid, and I would watch any movie that was on. I didn't care if it was dull. I loved the movies because they behave differently than real people. You know, people talk differently. They didn't talk like my parents. They entered rooms differently. They all wore suits and ties. I mean, they were just, you know, so I would watch everything. And I didn't know what I was watching one day, but I'm watching Stairway to Heaven.
Wow.
And I really thought that's what happens when you die. I took that all seriously, that when you die, a giant stairway actually comes down from heaven, stands there, and you get on it, and you go up. For years, I thought that was real. I mean, you know, so, and I never knew what film it was until years later. I'm going, oh, that's the one I learned about death from.
That's one of the greatest movies ever made, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, but he also did some earlier ones that are just, I mean, I don't think I've seen a Michael Powell film that I ever disliked.
And Peeping Tom was a masterpiece, but at the time it hurt his career.
Destroyed his career, basically, at the time. Because it's odd, because released the same year as Psycho, and Psycho, you know, the reviews were bad on Psycho, but the public loved it. It made a fortune. It was a game changer in film.
Changed film forever.
Yeah. Yet Peeping Tom destroyed Powell's career in England.
Yeah.
And when it was brought over here, it was released by a small independent company that, you know, just sold it as a regular horror film or something like that. So, you know, it was, I never understand that.
Crazy? Something that I didn't notice, and I don't know if you did it, you know, subconsciously, or if it was a homage to Peeping Tom, Bad Biology.
In what way?
That's fucking Peeping Tom. She's taking pictures of the fucking victims while they're dying, but it's a sex
orgasm.
Like, years later, I was like, wait, that's Bad fucking Bite. And I'm like, did Tannenbaum do it on purpose, or was it subconsciously? But you see the connection.
Yeah, I do now, but I didn't then.
You didn't notice that? Yeah.
Listen, I don't know about other people, but I'm pretty oblivious to my own stuff.
Oh, okay.
And I'll give you a perfect example. I'm watching my favorite science fiction horror film is a 1955 British Hammer film called The Quatermass Experiment, all right? Terrified me as a child, okay? And there's a scene in it where it's about an astronaut that comes back, send up in space, something goes where he comes back, and he starts changing into something. And midway through the film, the transformation is really severe. And there's a great moment where, and it's beautifully directed. It's directed like it's a documentary. It's directed like nothing to suggest it's a horror movie or anything fancy. It's directed so straight. It's great. But there's a scene with a small local zoo where the animals are all restless. They sense something wrong. And all of a sudden, the film cuts to a bunch of bushes, hedges, for no reason. Okay, then it cuts back to the animals. So now you've seen, wait, what's with those hedges? Then it cuts back to the hedges, and now the camera's inside the hedges, moving forward, dollying in very nicely until you realize middle of the frame, buried in the hedges, are two eyes that don't look human.
Wow.
Well, that just... All right? So as a kid, every time I'm in the woods, I was convinced those eyes are watching me. So anyway, I'm showing it to... every Thursday night, I have movie night with Mike Hunchback and Mike Diana. Okay, we've been doing this for years. And we're watching the Quatermass Experiment. And I said to them, my God, look at that. That is the scariest shot I've ever seen in a movie. It still bothers me today. And Mike Hunchback says, no kidding. And I said, what are you being snotty about? What do you mean, no kidding? And he points up to the basket case poster. And there's my version of the same shot. Now, I had no idea. I had no idea. And I'm looking at him going, oh, my God.
Wow.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
It's so obvious, but I miss all the, you know.
That's fucking hilarious.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, when, as you know, when we write, it's all just gut instinct. We don't intellectualize, so I don't think of that stuff. You know, we're thinking, what should she do? Let's have her take care. And just, boom, done. You don't think about where it comes from.
So... in the last 5 years, what are some titles that are new titles that you like?
A couple of years back, it felt like everything I'm seeing, I've seen already. Everything seemed to be a ripoff of what's something that's already been made. I mean, it was getting me bored, you know? Yeah. So I just stopped going. And I figured, and there's enough stuff in the past that keeps me interested. So I'd rather do archaeology in the back. But I've polluted myself recently. I've really, you know, done some damage because I bought myself a 65-inch 3D TV. And the quality of the 3D television is just a knockout. It's just flawless 3D. Unlike when you go to the movies and you're seeing, they're often improperly projected or projected too dark or this and that. Well, they're just knockouts. So I've become a real 3D whore. But it's forced me to watch movies I normally wouldn't watch. And some of that's been rough, man. I just can't. Oh, man.
What's the dance sequence you showed me? I'm like, you bought this DVD?
But it's great. It was a Step Up 3, I think it was.
and he's like, yo, watch the 3D and the dance moves in this scene.
The film.
Step Up. Yeah, I'm used to you showing me like vaginas with bugs on it.
Yeah, well, but
poles popping out of assholes.
The film is terrible, but the dance sequences are phenomenal. Am I right?
Yeah, I mean, they
are just so beautifully done. They're so well photographed. And I even, so I bought Step Up 4 and 5 also in 3D.
Yeah.
And they're not as good because they're doing more production dances rather than hip hop.
Oh, wow.
It has a flavor, but they're doing, I was disappointed.
Yeah, because you put me on to a lot of musical stuff where people didn't expect, oh, you had a lot of musicals?
But
even the Nicholas Brothers, the great tap dancers, you say, hey, R.A., you know, break dancing is great, but... check out some of the Nicholas Brothers.
Oh,
show me some
my
of the
God.
Tap
I don't think anybody even
them.
Remembers
yeah.
them. Their first film was a short, Vitaphone short, and they die at the end even and become skeletons. I mean, what the hell? But they're the best tap dancers that ever have lived. And they had a unique style. And I remember Gregory Hines said that they can't even do an autobiography about the Nicholas, I mean, a biography film about the Nicholas Brothers, because who can do that?
Yeah.
They'd have to do CGI tap dancing.
Yeah.
These guys would do these splits where they just up in the air, boom, split like this and bounce back up. You've never seen it. So one of the best is one of the few all-black films made by the majors. It's a film called Stormy Weather, starring Lena Horne and Bojangles, Bill Robinson.
Wow.
It was his last film. And, I mean, just to see him tap, do his flawless, but the film ends with the Nicholas Brothers doing the craziest sequence you've ever seen in your life. It is stunning. It's brilliant, and it's all, and Cab Calloway's doing all that early jive and it's just phenomenal. And Fred Astaire, who knows a little bit about dancing, called that sequence they did the single greatest dance scene he's ever seen in any motion picture.
Wow.
And I mean, I'm telling you, folks. There's so much stuff in the past that will knock you out.
What's a shot of your favorite? It doesn't have to be ever, but a shot in a film that just that shot just wow, like that shot is fucking unbelievably great.
Well, probably in Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, and it's not even unbelievably great. It's just the film. It just summed the film up to me the first time I watched it. It's when they're when Z-Man says, "You'll be superstars," and it cuts them singing in the long run, and then you see them in the recording studio, and all of a sudden there's a shot where you see them in the nightclub performing, and the shot is Dutched, it's tilted, and it almost made me cry. I thought, boom! That was like the perfect shot in the film. And wow. I sit through that movie waiting for that shot.
Wow.
That's I've seen...
I thought maybe you'd say The Searchers with the walk away.
Beyond the Valley of Dolls just hit me on an emotional thing.
So he wanted to ask you about Basket Case since he grew up on it.
Oh, my main question is, do you remember what was the main inspiration for the monster in Basket Case?
There's two parts to that. One was, no, I didn't know. I just, my first idea was have a monster in a basket, so I knew it had to be small, that would leap out when people opened it. I thought the idea of a malignant jack-in-the-box was funny. And I started writing scenes of the monster leaping out, but the film didn't make sense to me because I didn't know why would somebody carry around a monster in a basket. It made absolutely no sense. And I thought, well, I can't turn this into a movie because it just doesn't make any sense. And then I was in Times Square at Nathan's. They used to have where ABC has their studio now. It used to be a gigantic Nathan's with a downstairs. And I'm sitting there eating hot dogs, and I'm sitting there, and all of a sudden I think, well, what if they're brothers? And I went, holy my God, what if they're brothers? Oh, so all of a sudden that changed things, and I grabbed a pen. I always used to walk around with a pen and paper in my pocket, when I'm writing. And I had one tiny piece of paper, so I started writing on the napkins that I had already used with the mustard stains. And I wrote this whole speech that's almost word for word what I used in the film, where he explains about his brother. But then we had to make Belial. I remember seeing a medical book I have that showed a Siamese twin sticking out of somebody, but it was inverted. The head was in the body.
Oh.
It was just the body sticking out. Okay?
Wow.
But nevertheless, we really didn't know what we were going to want. And fortunately, I had a very talented makeup artist named Kevin Haney, who was coming to New York for the first time to hopefully get in the business, which he did. He very shortly ended up working on Saturday Night Live and with Dick Smith and everything. But I knew it should have Kevin Van Hentrick's face. Beyond that, we didn't know. So we bought all this plasticine, and we didn't even have enough plasticine. So we were, at one point, Kevin stuck a soda bottle in the back. And I said, oh, make that a bone.
Next time we're in New York, I'm going to take you to Frank's house so you could meet Belial. Yeah. He's there.
Yes.
He's just sitting next to the fucking couch like this. He's melting because it's like, the thing's old now. So you're responsible for one of the greatest kill scenes in the history of cinema, the blowjob scene in Brain Damage.
Yeah.
Did you have that idea before you wrote the script?
Before we wrote the script, Andre Blais, who invented the home video market, and he had suggested make two versions. We wanted an R-rated version for the theater, but then he said, give me an X or unrated version that we could sell on home video.
Oh.
He was he always came up with the ideas before everybody else was doing it. So I added in the script this blowjob scene, which I thought was hilarious because it's not a real blowjob. It just looks bad,
The monster goes in the guy's like he's all drunk and the girl goes down to give him a blowjob and a monster comes out in her mouth and the thing's going like that in her mouth, but it's a monster. It's not a dick,
And it ends up, instead of a cum shot, he pulls her brains out, and then goes in the fly, which is really disgusting. But it turns out that things changed and the film, Andre formed a company called Palisades, and those people were running it, and they hated Brain Damage, and they hated me for making it. And they're on the phone saying, we don't, this is pornography. And I'm going, oh, God. All right. So anyway. So, but it played like that in Europe, everywhere in Europe.
Arguably your best film. A lot of people think that, too. I'm not saying it is.
I think the best film is Bad Biology.
Oh.
But I think, no, really, I do. I think it's the most.
He loves it. He calls me up and plays the movie laughing and reading the lines. Yeah. And I'm like, leave me the fuck alone. And he watches it with all his boys and shit.
Bad Biology?
Yeah.
Well, to me, it's.
He watches it all the time.
To me, basically, everything we set out to do, we did, and even better than the script. To me, it's the most perfect film I've made.
Wow.
I love it. Like,
you know what the strange thing is?
I love it.
Yeah.
The strange thing about Bad Biology, especially in Europe, the biggest fans of the film are women.
Yeah. Well, because of the character, the female character.
That's it, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And again, in South America, after the film, the women were coming up to me saying, thank you so much for making that. It's a brilliant film of this. Mm-hmm. And I said, why? And they said, because it's such a strong female. It's she's so emancipated. She's, and I said, but you realize she's crazy. And they went, yeah, but beside that, you know, which really surprised me. I mean, I'm glad of that, you know. Yeah. And because I remember when I first, when we did Frankenhooker, the first review was in Variety that said, a misogynistic piece of trash, and clearly the director hates women. And yet, it's the women who got the point of that film.
Yeah, that's usually how it is.
You know what I mean? So what's great is I love going to these conventions and stuff like that. And, you know, when people are in costume, especially on Saturday night, half the women seem to be dressed as Frankenhooker. It's phenomenal.
Another one of your idols or a filmmaker that you have so much respect for is John Huston.
Oh, God, yeah.
And,
I mean, Jesus. He's one of these, you know, a lot of directors make, you know, they make films all their life, and not everyone is a masterpiece. And John Huston made some films that are not good. Who cares? He made a bunch that are so pure perfection, you know, he's allowed to make any shit he wants at this point, you know?
Yeah.
Nine the Iguana
yeah.
is so brilliant, so important, so emotional. It's hard to describe the impact that film has.
Yeah,
and it's just a brilliant, 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 brilliant film. And I told you about the time I quote-unquote not met him, but saw him. I'm walking down the street heading towards like 7th Avenue. All of a sudden there's a limousine and he gets out and he's big white beard, but he's all in white, a white suit. White everything.
And he plays God in the movie The Bible. He's the God.
But
you know?
I saw my first image, I knew who he was.
He plays the God and Noah.
And to me, he seemed to be 11 feet tall. And I knew who he was immediately. And I just froze watching him. I just froze thinking, I'm looking at God. I mean, that's how it felt to me.
I was in Cali years ago, like in the early 90s, and I seen Liam Neeson. He just did Schindler's List, and Angelica Huston was at the table.
Oh, yeah.
And Irvin Azoff brought us into this fancy spot, and I was like, yo, it's Darkman, because that's all I knew Liam Neeson. And he's like, hey, and I'm like, Angelica, your father's the fucking man. That's crazy. I said, hey, Darkman, could you sign this? Could you write something about Darkman? He did, and he said, warm regards, Liam Neeson. And I said, and I wrote Darkman for him. I was like, Darkman.
Why didn't he? He didn't like it? Well,
I didn't know him. I didn't even see Schindler's List at the time. I just knew Darkman. I'm like, but she's with fucking John Huston's daughter, Angelica Huston.
Yeah, I mean, his first one was Maltese Falcon. So he's
Falcon,
starting off great.
Treasure of the Sierra Madre, all of those.
Yeah, African Queen.
Asphalt Jungle,
Jesus. God,
you didn't love it. I love Wise Blood, but you wasn't a huge fan of Wise Blood.
No, I'm not
Blood.
A huge fan of
I
that.
I really love it, yeah.
And then he did a film called Under the Volcano, which
Albert
is... I'll never watch it again in my life. And yet I own it. If it comes out on Blu-ray, I'm going to buy it, but I'll never watch it again. It was the most heart-wrenchingly depressing film I've ever seen. It was so effective, I just can't go through that again. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Why do I want to suffer? but it'll always be in my library, but I will never watch that film again. It was so powerful, so strong, so unbearable, actually.
Yeah. And it just reeked Huston every shot.
Oh, every shot. Every moment of it was. Yeah, every moment of it was. And recently, and I'm a jerk, you know, where I just decided, no, that's not for me. But when The Bible came out, I thought, what a sellout. I was just disgusted John Huston did it.
Yeah.
And because I'm thinking, I don't know, it just seemed like such a stupid-ass idea, and I didn't want anything to do with it. I only caught up with it, I think, last year on Blu-ray.
Wow.
And I thought it was so brilliant. I was so embarrassed that I had, you know, ignored it for so long.
You know,
such a brilliant
You know what's great about
film.
That, though, is because Huston was a straight-up atheist, you know, supposedly.
Yep, yeah.
So he was directing the story of the Bible. So he made the Bible.
He did.
Where, like, you got Aronofsky, who does Noah, and now it's like, you know, he's left and he's atheist. So he, like... They won't say God, they'll say the one and all this other cold shit, and they rewrote it like God's getting revenge because we're hurting the plants and all that. It's like,
your
political views is one thing, but come on, the story's already well written. You got the story.
Wait a minute. It's bad enough if you're not going to say God, but worse than that, you add stone monsters.
I didn't know they put stone monsters in it.
I'm serious. You're watching
big CGI
monsters. And you know what? You know how I know? You know why I own it? It was in 3D.
Oh, so you watched it.
I'm sitting there watching.
They put stone monsters in the fucking Noah's Ark.
Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking, boy, I missed that one somehow. I mean,
where the fuck was that in the book?
Yeah, that wasn't in. I mean, John Huston missed that stuff. So unbelievable.
You know, because Hollywood, they're better at writing stories than the Bible. You know, they let's improve this.
Oh, I know. And it's,
next thing they're going to be like, well, let's put some robots in Moses.
Well, I mean, are you sitting there and you're watching Russell Crowe, who's very sincere in the film, talk to these stone monsters? I mean, what do you. What do you do with that one?
You do nothing with it.
To me, the film was over at that point, you know?
Yeah, like, I didn't even see Noah, and that sounds crazy. Stone monsters.
Yeah, yeah.
That's fucking it. Oh, yeah, did you ever see Prom Night 2, Hello, Mary Lou? You got to watch that one. It's, like, so 80s, over-the-top 80s. But they named the chick in the movie after Henelotta.
You know what happened? We were watching the movie, and I caught that they were naming a couple of characters.
Like Carpenter, yeah, Craven.
I'm thinking, oh, they're doing directors. But they named the bad girl after me. Which I thought was kind of cool.
And they named the girl who sucked cock to fucking become the prom queen?
Yeah, right.
It's like, hey, we give someone else to it.
Well, no, when we left there, somebody says, that's really cool having your name in the film. I said, yeah, I'm the cocksucker. You know.
James Gunn in Slither, he named the bar Hen and Ladders, you know, stuff like that. So he's not saying it, but I'm saying give the motherfucker $20 million to make a movie, James Gunn. $20 million.
It's not how it works, unfortunately. Because he's got to get the money, $20 million from a studio, and no studio is going to even consider it.
Yeah.
You know, that's how that stuff works.
Real quick, Otto Preminger. We'll name two more filmmakers.
Okay, Otto Preminger is right now my favorite director on the planet. And I just love everything he does. And it's like, if you want to learn how to direct, watch an Otto Preminger film. Watch Advice and Consent, or an Anatomy of a Murder. He's the master of, well, I didn't mean this way, but he's the master of master shots.
Wow.
He films in scope, and he can do one continuous take, 5 minutes, something like this, and he blocks the actors so that you're not even aware the camera's been rolling. They move from a wide shot into an over-the-shoulder, into a close-up, into a pan. I mean, it is the most incredible filmmaking I've ever seen. And the ending of Advice and Consent, which is the punchline of the film, the moment where you gasp at what has happened, is one long take. That the camera begins on Lou Ayres and moves to him and Lawton, and then goes up to Walter Pigeon, and then goes up high. And I mean, holy mother of God, the guy is just brilliant.
Favorite Cronenberg film?
Oh, definitely The Brood.
Oh, yeah, that's what
it
is.
I mean, it's the only film he needed to make, as far as I'm concerned. Wow. I mean, I can watch that every minute, every day.
What did you love about The Brood?
See, I get sick of horror films that do the same thing.
Yeah.
We got to kill the people after having sex, or the girl and this. In The Brood, he was killing old people. And a school teacher. I mean, it was just so shocking. It was beautiful. And it was the third Cronenberg film I had seen, and I really all of a sudden felt like I was seeing an old friend. It was just incredible. Wow. And it's out on Criterion on Blu-ray, and I don't like what they did. Apparently, Cronenberg changed the contrast in the film.
Oh.
So it's like watching the film with sunglasses. I hate it. Yeah, because
what was good was the browns and the oranges.
Well, the idea of...
They took them out?
Yeah. I mean, when you see the children in front of the school in a bright, sunny day, that's beautiful. Now it's an overcast day, and it's almost like a horror cliche. Oh. Fortunately, it's available in England in the original version, so I'm happy,
okay,
you know?
Okay, okay.
But and I also like his film Crash.
Yeah, oh, I love Crash.
Oh,
yeah,
my God.
Yeah. Okay, so one of the last questions, Super Crack.
What about it?
What the fuck? What put that in your brain to invent Super Crack?
Well,
if you haven't seen Frankenhooker, that's the main guy, Jeffrey, he invents Super Crack and blows up a bunch of prostitutes.
See, okay, it's two parts of the question. One is...
They smoke and they explode.
I'm writing a comedy, and I realized if Jeffrey actually kills anybody, you're going to hate him for the rest of the film. It's not a comedy. I'm trapped. I'm making a horror film. He's got to kill them. How do I do it? And I thought, okay, what if it's accidental? Well, and then I came up with the idea of, well, what if he plans on killing them with super crack and they find it and they smoke it themselves and blow up? It's the funniest thing I've ever done. In fact, I want that on my gravestone. He exploded 8 hookers in a hotel room. That's what it should say. You know? But where I got that from was when we were making Brain Damage, the crack epidemic hit New York. And we were filming on 33rd Street, I think between 9th and 10th. And one side of the street was where the railroad tracks are. And it was Hooker Central at night. And the hookers would work the cars. They would get in the car and do it and then get out. We used to film them from the second floor window with an early video camera that you could see in the dark pretty much. In the morning, I'd walk to the down the street, and the sidewalk was littered with used condoms and crack vials. And I'd be walking there, and my footsteps would be going crunch. I mean, depending on what I'm stepping on, it was just disgusting. I'd open the door to go up to to the building we rented the floors in, and there'd be a girl in there, and I'd say to her, "Oh, you know, the sun's already up." She goes, "Oh my God, really?" I'm going, "Yeah, it's 7:30." Oh, I'm sorry, and I felt
out,
bad
cracked
for
out, cracked out.
Yeah, and I remember this one really attractive woman. She looked like a model, and she was in this area, and within the 2 months that we were there, to see her completely deteriorate.
Wow.
I mean, she had what I used to call a crack elbow because you can't keep your hands down. Your hands are like spazzing out. So it was, at the time, an epidemic in the city. And that was in my mind. So when I did Frankenhooker, I thought, let me take it one step further. It was a better joke back then because everybody was aware how topical crack was.
Yeah.
You know.
No, but it's a time capsule, legendary joke now.
Yeah, but I mean, audiences back then, as soon as they heard the word super crack, they were hysterical laughing.
Yeah, exactly. All right, I think we're done. Hey, Frank, man,
okay.
I love you, man.
Thank you for
coming through. Afro, thanks for being...
This is a privilege.
Oh,
it's an honor, sir. Really, really. This is incredible for me, too.
Look at his big smiley head. All right, we're done. That was painless enough, right?
Yeah.
Good.
It felt like 15 minutes.
Yeah. Not to them.
I had fun.